They snap it. They're going for it. They flood it right. Caught. Tyreek Hill stays in bounds. And Chad Henne out of the bullpen. The Kansas City Chiefs are going to advance in the AFC playoffs.
It was not how anyone drew it up, but the Kansas City Chiefs, behind backup quarterback Chad Henne, are headed to the AFC Championship. The NFL's divisional round gave us shockers and controversies and maybe our last glimpse of a legend. So Bill Barnwell stops by to help us make sense of all of it. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, January 18th. This is ESPN Daily. All right. Okay. 3, 2, 1. Bill, I just want to dive into it here because there's a lot to get to after watching the Bucs beat the Saints 30-20. So New Orleans had beaten Tampa Bay twice this season in week one, about 400 years ago, and then again in November. So what was the difference in this game versus those other two?
It's really simple, Pablo. I mean, the Saints just didn't protect the football. In the two regular season games between these teams, the Saints won the turnover battle both times. They were +3 in the week one victory and then one up in the rematch. Tom Brady threw 5 picks across those two games, only 7 in his other 14 games. It really felt like the Saints had his number and they were going to have to flip that to win in New Orleans. Well, they flipped it. The Bucs didn't turn the ball over. And the Saints coughed it up 4 times, including 3 interceptions from Drew Brees. The Bucs turned the first 3 takeaways into touchdowns and used the 4th to wrap up the game and kneel down. It's virtually impossible to win a playoff game with that sort of margin. The Saints were just sloppy in this game. I mean, Brees could have thrown 4 or 5 picks. He threw an awful interception under pressure for the first one and wasn't on the same page with Alvin Kamara on a seam route for the second interception. The third bounced off Jared Cook, who also fumbled away a completion on a drive where the Saints were looking to go up 2 scores. They lost the ball and proceeded to give up 17 unanswered points to end their season.
So clearly the Bucs had a formula of sorts for stopping Brees, and it seemed like every aspect of this game, but it's not just that they stopped him, it's that they made him look straight up terrible really often. And I'm wondering, how did they do that to that degree?
Well, Pablo, I really think that Todd Bowles and that Bucs defense looked at the tape from last week's game against the Bears, looked at how Drew Brees was playing, looked at how those receivers were moving, and just didn't think there was anybody in that lineup who could reliably win against man coverage or beat them downfield with their speed. This was especially true after the Saints lost Deontay Harris, who had 2 long punt returns early in this game to a neck injury. The Saints did get a long touchdown, but it was not with Brees on the field. It was the lone snap for one Jameis Winston, who came in and used the same trick play the Bears ran against them last week for a long touchdown.
Coming across is Sanders. They hand it to him. Reverse goes to Jameis, and they got a man wide open. Traquan Smith at the 25, 15, 10, 5, and a touchdown Saints, and Jameis Winston with a touchdown pass against his former team.
But overall, when Brees was on the field, it was pretty clear that the game plan was to dare him and his receivers to try and take shots towards the sidelines and get downfield. And the game plan worked. The Bucs used heavy doses of twists and stunts up front to create pressure and then just smothered Brees' receivers. Honestly, it really felt like the only reason Sean Payton didn't bench Brees for Winston on the last drive of the game is because it was probably the last few snaps of Drew Brees' career.
And it's worth being clear about this too, Bill. Jay Glazer reported at the outset of this game that this was going to be Drew Brees' last game in the Superdome. And for whatever it's worth, he looked appropriately emotional post-game, but if this is it for Brees after 2 decades of us watching him in the NFL, what do you think his legacy is going to be in this sport?
I would say he goes out as probably the greatest free agent signing in the history of the National Football League. And on top of that, alongside his head coach, Sean Payton, these are the guys who saved football in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. All those years ago, in San Diego, the Chargers were benching Brees routinely for a 41-year-old Doug Flutie in 2003. They drafted Eli Manning and then traded Manning for Philip Rivers to replace Drew Brees in the starting lineup. And of course, he turned his career around. He made his way to free agency 2 years later, and Nick Saban's Dolphins were about to sign Drew Brees in a move which would have changed the course of football history at the college and pro levels on so many levels. He goes on to New Orleans instead. The rest is history.
Yes.
And I mean, the numbers are there. The legacy is there in terms of winning a Super Bowl. But honestly, Pablo, my favorite part of Drew Brees' career was pretty much the very end. Because what he did, even though it didn't go well in the playoffs, even though he wasn't throwing downfield all that frequently, he really shifted the landmarks for what is even possible to do as a pro quarterback. This is a guy who set the NFL's completion percentage record in 2017 at 72%. Pushed it 2.4 percentage points higher the following year, and then basically sustained that mark again in 2019. In the modern era of football, teams throw shorter, complete more passes, and move the chains more frequently than ever before. Like Andy Reid as a coach, Brees shifted the entire league in his image.
So let's shift now to Andy Reid and to that Browns-Chiefs game, Bill, because I am still kind of reeling from that one, honestly, all these hours later. And I want to start at the very end to set the scene. Patrick Mahomes is out with a concussion. Backup Chad Henne is suddenly in. It is 4th and inches, and the Chiefs are at midfield, and they need a first down to seal the game, basically. So what did you make of Andy Reid's call there at the end with Chad Henne, and what did it say about Andy Reid?
I'm just so proud of Andy Reid, Pablo. It's so great. For years, as someone who backed and supported Andy Reid, I saw his teams fall short in the playoffs when he would mismanage late game situations or forget how the clock worked at the most crucial parts of games. In last year's Super Bowl, almost in real time, we saw him level up. We saw him send out the Chiefs' kicking game for an early field goal on 4th and short near the goal line. Then he changed his mind, sent the offense back out. The Chiefs scored a touchdown, and it helped end up being pretty significant in terms of the margin of victory for them winning Andy Reid's first Super Bowl as a head coach. And I have to admit, I'm not sure the old Andy, as much as I loved him, would have made this decision. This is new Andy, and new Andy played against the trope and fooled the one man in the NFL it is impossible to fool. That's Tony Romo. So like you said, facing 4th and inches with the clock running, the Chiefs line up Chad Henne in the shotgun with no running backs as if he's going to throw the ball. Imagine how crazy that would be. They motion a running back into the backfield, giving the tiniest hint like they might run a play at a shotgun. But Romo is rightly noting that the Chiefs don't have the body language like they're going to actually snap the ball, and they're just going to try and hard count the Browns into going offsides. I was agreeing with him, to be clear, in my living room, 100%. I thought there was a 0% chance the Chiefs were about to snap this ball. And then, shockingly, they snapped the ball. Tyreek Hill ran a quick out and caught a pass from Chad Henne, a guy who, honestly, I had forgotten was in the NFL until he came in this very game before running forward for the first down to seal the contest up.
So the reason the game was as tight as it was at that pivotal moment, it stems from a super controversial call of a different kind. Right before the half, Baker Mayfield had thrown this bomb, Bill, to Rashard Higgins, who got hit helmet to helmet, causing Higgins to fumble the ball forward, then out of the end zone, which triggered, by rule, a touchback.
Higgins to the right, Mayfield to throw, drop, look, fire, and it's caught wide open at the 5. It's Higgins, he fumbles into the end zone. Let's see what they're going to call. It's a touchback. He fumbled into the end zone and out of the end zone.
Twitter exploded in an almost unanimous hatred of this rule, Bill. It was kind of like the exact opposite of how Twitter feels about Ted Lasso. So help me understand why this rule is so bad and what we should be doing about it instead.
The bad rule. It's so bad, Pablo. Because we treat a fumble going out of the end zone as if it's different from a fumble at any other spot on the football field. If you don't know, if a ball is fumbled out of bounds in the field of play, it's returned to the spot on the field where it was fumbled back to the offense. But because Rashard Higgins was reaching into the end zone and the ball went through the sideline, there was always a touchback and the ball was given to the Chiefs on the 20-yard line. Daniel Sorensen should have been flagged for illegally lowering his head to create contact and force the fumble, But not only was that not called, it's not reviewable. And there are all kinds of fraught arguments about what the rule should become. But the best idea I've ever heard, not about, to be clear, not about just this fumble, but also in general, the best idea I've ever heard, is something that was pitched to me on Twitter in 2017 by a user named, ironically, ChiefDog10. ChiefDog10 suggested what I call the reverse touchback. If you fumble into the end zone under the rules of this reverse touchback and it goes out of bounds without being recovered, the ball is moved back to the defense's 20-yard line. The down counts, so you can't use a fumble to get a first down. There's a clear punishment to discourage players from just wildly reaching the ball forward anywhere near the end zone. But this does not create a turnover. I really believe this could make sense. It could work. It's a good compromise. And we can all do better if we just trust in ChiefDog10.
I want to get to this story at the very end here before we get to Saturday's games, Bill, because Adam Schefter has reported that Deshaun Watson, a quarterback you've written about extensively, may have played his last game as a Houston Texan. And there's been this whole soap opera off the field in Houston. We'll try to get into that later this week on this podcast. But right now, with suitors lining up around the block, where do you think the best landing spot is for Deshaun Watson?
Well, I would tell you I don't love either of the most prominent or obvious destinations for Deshaun Watson. The Dolphins are the easy pick. They have the draft picks. They have the cap space to trade for Watson. They have a possible trade at quarterback and Tua Tagovailoa. But they're going to have their third offensive coordinator in 3 years. They don't have very much in the way of weapons. And they still have a middling offensive line after sending Laremy Tunsil, coincidentally, to the Texans. The Jets have that franchise left tackle in Mekhi Becton, but they have a bottom five roster elsewhere, and they would trade away most of their future draft picks just to acquire Watson. I think it'd be very similar to what he has in Houston, where they have a good top-level talent core, but very little around those four or five star pieces. To me, the best landing spot for Watson would be the Colts, but it's hard to imagine the Texans trading their star quarterback in the division and seeing him twice a year for the next decade. Given the various options, given who has the cap space, who is likely to make this sort of deal, I like the 49ers as a team that has a great offensive coach, weapons across the board, and a solid offensive line. The Niners were a Super Bowl team last year with Jimmy Garoppolo. Watson would be a major upgrade. And on top of that, we know how much the Texans love former Patriots. So this would be a chance for them to add another one if they do decide to give in to Watson's wishes and hit the reset button.
Okay, Bill, up next, I need you to help me make sense of what happened to the Rams against the Packers, and also what football scholars like yourself found most interesting about the Ravens losing to the Bills.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So, Bill, I want to turn to Saturday's game in the NFC because we got to see the Packers just blow out the Rams 32-18. And we also saw Aaron Rodgers do a couple of impressive things. He threw two touchdowns. He ran for another. He also, like, smirked a couple times, which is just wildly demoralizing. So is the story of this game just as simple as Rodgers playing this whole season, basically, like he's immortal?
I think in the long run, yes, although it didn't have to be that way. And I think that's the frustrating thing if you're the Rams. Because, yes, Aaron Rodgers was awesome in this game, and let's not put that aside. But what's frustrating for the Los Angeles Rams is that I think they really had a shot here, Pablo. I mean, Jared Goff was not 100%, pretty clearly. He didn't throw the ball downfield very frequently. But we headed into this game thinking he was going to be a disaster. And that was not the case. He was pretty good. Cam Akers ran the ball 18 times for 90 yards and even took some snaps as a Wildcat quarterback and scoring a touchdown on one of those plays. The defense came up with a couple stops in the second half. There was a window and a universe, not this universe, but maybe a slightly different universe where the Rams win this game. And there were a couple problems. I think that with Aaron Donald reduced to mere mortal status after suffering a rib injury against the Seahawks, Los Angeles's margin for error was just too thin. Mm. They didn't take advantage of the opportunities they had to flip this game. They lined up to go for it on 4th and 1 in the first half, try and score a touchdown, which is what you should do when you're an underdog against a historically great quarterback. They commit a false start. They kick a field goal. They drop 2 would-be Rodgers interceptions at the end of the second quarter on their 2-minute drill, and the Packers kicked a field goal. Crucially, and this was the most important one, the Rams were within a touchdown in the fourth quarter, and they forced rookie running back A.J. Dillon to fumble. Unfortunately, Aaron Rodgers somehow, mysteriously, happens to be right there to recover the fumble, even runs forward for a couple of yards. 3 plays later, Rodgers went deep and hit Alan Lazard for a 58-yard touchdown to seal the game.
Rodgers takes, fakes the handoff, looks to throw, lofts it down the middle. Lazard's got it, and he's gone! He is gone! Touchdown! The Packers with a dagger!
I think that even given that the Rams played better than we might have expected, and even given that Rodgers was so good, the fact that they didn't get those breaks ended up costing them their shot at winning.
It's worth noting as well, Bill, that the Rams had decided to go all in on this team and all in on the present tense. I mean, they're paying Jared Goff, Aaron Donald, Jalen Ramsey, an average of, I believe, $77 million a year. So what does a game like this indicate about a strategy that to me at one point seemed almost NBA style, like it was top heavy, very much oriented around their stars?
Real Knicks energy when it comes to this Rams team. More successful than the Knicks, to be fair. But yeah, this loss had real, well, if it isn't the consequences of my actions vibes for the Rams. I mean, this organization's philosophy is very simple. Like you said, they're going to invest their cap dollars and their first round picks to acquire 7 or 8 superstars in free agency via trade, like they did for Jared Goff and Jalen Ramsey. And they're going to build the rest of the team around those guys on the cheap. And the problem is that you need those guys to be effective, healthy, and actually impacting the game on a week-to-week basis. And the Rams just didn't have that happening on Sunday. Aaron Donald labored through a tough game, only played 56% of the defensive snaps. In the playoffs, typically he's playing every single snap when he's healthy. Cooper Kupp was out. Goff was pretty good, all things considered, but he was playing through a broken thumb. Andrew Whitworth, star left tackle, is playing through a knee injury. Jalen Ramsey was healthy, but the Rams stayed in a lot of zone coverage to try and avoid giving up big plays for most of this game, so he wasn't able to follow Devontae Adams around. And on top of all that, the Rams have more than $31 million in dead money on their cap after they used this past offseason to get out of the Brandon Cooks and Todd Gurley deals. But both of those guys were superstar additions and contracts the Rams regretted quickly. So if they have all those guys and they're all at 100% and they're all impacting the game, this might have turned out differently.
So speaking of regret, I want to spin back to Rodgers for a second here, Bill, because I really want to know how the Packers front office feels about drafting Jordan Love in the first round of the NFL draft in April, because I feel like there is this prevailing theory that taking Jordan Love made Aaron Rodgers play out of his mind, like he was motivated to play even better than he already is. And I don't think that's entirely ridiculous. I just also feel like strategically planting, I don't know, like an anonymous quote in the press somewhere might have been a lot cheaper than spending a first rounder on a backup quarterback. So how do you think the Packers front office is feeling right now about that?
I think the Packers are probably thrilled that they managed to somehow not only give in to what the popular opinion was and surround Aaron Rodgers with help, but get an MVP season from their quarterback while also, at least theoretically, solidifying their future. And I don't think that Aaron Rodgers was not going to try hard this year. I don't think he was not motivated to do it. But when I wrote about this, it feels like a decade ago, but it was in April.
Yeah.
I sort of looked at Aaron Rodgers' history, and this was a guy who nobody doubted for a decade. I mean, really, going back to that last Super Bowl victory, I mean, he had his ups and downs, of course. He got hurt a couple times. They had some disappointing performances in the playoffs, but there was never any hint that Aaron Rodgers was being treated as anything less than an absolute superstar franchise quarterback who the Packers would never even consider moving on from until they drafted Jordan Love. And after they drafted Jordan Love, I think there was this popular perception of, okay, yeah, actually, Aaron Rodgers kind of is on the decline. His numbers have dropped off three consecutive years. He hasn't been that same guy who was threatening teams downfield that he was 5 years ago. He hasn't been that absolutely terrifying quarterback you would never want to play in the postseason. I do think that it wasn't just strictly the Love pick, but I think that general perception of, oh, Aaron Rodgers is on his way out, when it came to his performance, when it came to the draft, when it came to looking at his contract, I think all of that might have spurred Aaron Rodgers to have a spectacular season. But at the end of the day, this is a guy who was absolutely terrifying. The Packers, of course, might have thought about Jordan Love being their quarterback as early as 2021. Right now, it feels like he's years away from getting a shot to take this job over.
So let's stick to the quarterbacks question, because in the Saturday night game between the Ravens and Bills, it was billed, no pun intended, as this offensive duel, Bill Barnwell, between two quarterbacks, Lamar Jackson and Josh Allen. And we got a 3-3 game at halftime. So was this game boring to you, or was it interesting inside of your particular football brain on some sort of other level?
Okay, I think if you're a football nerd, this game was interesting. I think if you're watching to be entertained, not so much. It was kind of boring, especially during the first half of the contest. But there was a lot to really unpack here that I thought was really interesting. So let's start with the win. I think that was a bigger factor than anybody was expecting. It cost each team a long touchdown pass, and both kickers missed a pair of field goals. And to emphasize, Pablo, how significant this win was in this game, Justin Tucker, the star Ravens kicker, the metronome of the football world, has had two entire seasons where he only missed one field goal the entire year. He missed his first two kicks on Saturday, two in a row. I didn't know that was possible.
Kicking from the left hash. Snap is down. Tucker's kick is on the way. It is up. And this one hits the right upright again. It is no good.
Then he hit one off either goalpost, which I know you feel this way. I feel the same way. You should get points for hitting the goalpost. Is that fair to say?
It's so impressive. Like, you should get 4 points. Unfortunately for Justin Tucker, that is, however, not a rule.
No, this is not Rock and Jack football. Dan Cortez and Coolio are not part of the NFL postseason. That is another conversation for another day. But what was fascinating about this to me is that, especially in the first half, we saw these teams adopt really unique game plans. The Ravens are known for their blitzing on defense. They've been their calling card now for two decades throughout different coordinators, throughout different personnel. They are going to blitz you. But they were facing a quarterback in Josh Allen who has been destroying blitzes all season. So they adjusted. They blitzed at their lowest rate all season in the first half, and Josh Allen was just 1 of 4 against that blitz in the first two quarters. And the Bills, they responded. They totally abandoned the run. And that makes sense. They were playing a Ravens defense, which by the Football Outsiders efficiency stat DVOA, they were third in the NFL against the run this year, but just 17th against the pass. So attack your team's weakness. The Bills called 24 pass plays against just one run play in the first half of this game. The game really swung in the third quarter and what became not a pick six, Pablo, but a pick 12. And then on third down, the big play hit. Lamar Jackson threw the first interception in the red zone of his entire NFL career. And Taron Johnson took it 101 yards the other way for a defensive touchdown.
Lamar Jackson back to throw, guns it into the end zone, intercepted! 2 yards deep in the end zone, intercepted by Taron Johnson. And he brings it out, and he's still on the run. He may go all the way. Touchdown! Touchdown! Taron Johnson goes 102 yards with an end zone.
It was a 12-point swing in terms of those scores. Another bad snap on the next drive led to Jackson suffering a concussion, but honestly, by then, it already felt like Baltimore's chances of winning this game were over.
So I want to end here with Diggs and Allen and those Bills. They're headed to their first AFC Championship game for the first time since 1994, and it has been a pretty nerve-wracking two playoff games so far, and it's notable to me, at least, that like in a sort of cosmic reversal, like the ghost of Scott Norwood is really helping them with special teams luck. You mentioned Justin Tucker and the Doigs. You've mentioned just the luck they've benefited from. So based on what you've seen from the Bills here, can Buffalo and its defense keep winning the way they have so far?
Oof. Well, I can account for the cosmos, Pablo. I've told you this over and over again. There's no algorithm that accounts for the cosmos and the ghost of Scott Norwood. But I will say this much. The Bills, if we're being honest, have been a little lucky on defense so far this year. The key part here has been how they've played in the red zone. They've allowed the Colts and the Ravens to make 8 trips into the red zone across these 2 games. They've only allowed 2 touchdowns. The Bills have forced 2 stops on downs, a missed field goal, a pick 6, and 2 field goals, in addition to those 2 touchdowns, which is great. It's a classic example of a bend but don't break defense, which you always hear about in the NFL. The problem is that that defense does not exist. It is a made-up thing if you look at it closely. The Bills weren't that sort of defense during the regular season. That's not been their philosophy. They didn't suddenly just figure that out right now. It's the same way, actually, Tennessee got into the AFC Championship game a year ago, when they held the Patriots and the same Baltimore Ravens to 2 red zone touchdowns on 7 trips in their 2 upset victories last year. When they got to the AFC Championship game, though, and they faced the Chiefs scored 2 touchdowns on 3 red zone trips and won comfortably. So the Bills either have to keep this up in the red zone or find a new formula on defense to make it to the Super Bowl.
Bill Barnwell, thank you for bringing a rational order to the playoff cosmos on ESPN Daily.
One day I will be the ghost haunting this show, Pablo. Thank you.
All right, up next, one of my favorite retired baseball players, Doug Glanville, reflects on what being a Black father means for his next move in the game.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
Here's another story I want you to know. Doug Glanville had a long and successful career in Major League Baseball, and like many former players, he's long thought about returning to the game in a different role. That's why he interviewed to be Tampa Bay's manager back in 2014, for instance. But while more voices are calling for diversity in baseball today, Doug's wary of the compromises such a job requires, now more than ever. Here's Doug Glanville in a new essay for ESPN to explain.
I check all of the boxes to be a Major League Baseball manager. I played 9 seasons in the big leagues with the Philadelphia Phillies, Chicago Cubs, and Texas Rangers. I've been an executive subcommittee member in the Players Association, and I'm well-versed in baseball governance. I have an Ivy League degree at a time when that means a lot for executive opportunity in baseball. I've been a candidate before, and I believe I have the voice and the drive to be excellent. But I can't be your managerial candidate right now. That truth has a lot to do with another box I check, Black father. As is the case with any candidate who's a dad of young kids, I'd fear missing major milestones in my family life and the guilt of putting so much on my spouse. But as a Black father in 2021, this compromise becomes a deal breaker for me. How can I leave my children for extended periods of time when every day the poison of racism makes me fear for their safety? This past year has given us even more indisputable evidence of systemic racism, at times shared in stark brutality on camera. The recent events in Washington, D.C. only crystallized what I already knew, that our country has 2 competing stories, and the central conflict is power and race. it's hard to address my children's questions about why a predominantly white mob would garner favoritism relative to a peaceful black assembly at the U.S. Capitol. It was hard not to be afraid for the future because of how much this untethered terror reminded me of the worst of the past. And my four kids, all under the age of 13, are paying attention. I need to be present as they ask probing questions. I want to share firsthand experience. I want them to retain hope. I want them to empathize with others. And I want them to understand that the advantages of my being a former big leaguer do not make them immune to racism. In 2014, I interviewed with the Tampa Bay Rays, knowing I was a long shot to be their next manager. The Rays brought in what must have been the most diverse field of candidates in history. Meanwhile, back in black life at my home in Connecticut, I was in the final stages of civic battle. I'd fought to change state law after encountering a police officer in my very own driveway. On a snowy day, I'd gone out to shovel my driveway. I saw a police vehicle from the next town over drive down the street and park across from my house. After a few minutes, an officer got out of the car and approached me. He rudely asked me if I was shoveling other people's driveways to make some extra bucks. I said no, it was my home. After exchanging a few more words, he said, "Happy shoveling," and left. And I stood there, feeling robbed of my dignity and my rights on my own property. For the next 18 months, I sought restorative justice through countless meetings, community engagement, and sit-downs with my family. The Glanville Law was born in response to my complaint, reinforcing the boundaries of police jurisdiction. I didn't get the Rays job, and I returned to sports media, which I enjoy immensely. I've received more interest in working for various teams, and while I'm grateful, I haven't actively pursued them. Understand, there is a need to rectify racial inequality in baseball, and being in that manager's office would be an opportunity to shape the culture, to unearth winning outside of traditional bias. But black managers also face few guarantees. A great mentor, Dusty Baker, has had an incredibly successful career by any standard, approaching 2,000 wins and managing against the tides as a black leader. Yet, he's also lost jobs, even after making the playoffs and winning 90-plus games in a season. Most recently, jobless for 2 years after winning 97 games, one of the most iconic black managers in history was asked to clean up the mess after a once-in-a-century scandal in Houston. Being black, you pay attention to how your few representatives in the sport are treated. I believe I'd be a success in the dugout, yet I have this horrible feeling about walking out the door for a year, not being there to help my kids navigate this painful time, only to walk into a job where I could be reduced to checking a box for diversity without the organization fully appreciating what it means to live in that box. I realize that many committed family men find careers in the game of baseball. They make it work. They combine the two worlds. I have great appreciation for that. But if we truly value diversity, we have to do more than make a few hires and post Black Lives Matter signs. We have to understand what diverse candidates face every day, build in support, and change the culture around that. I am preparing my young children to face the world, just as white supremacy has been given the biggest hall pass in generations. I still believe the game can make the world better for all of our children, even as I choose to cheer from afar.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.